Back together again, you and I, midweek Wednesday style, January 24th, 2024, on Connecticut Today. We broke from the gate with a controversial quote from a Fairfield County legislator surrounding a hotly contested proposed regulation in Hartford. Former Time Magazine senior reporter Alan Sanders commented on Donald Trump's Tuesday primary win in New Hampshire. Yankee Institute blogger Megan Portfolio stopped by with her thoughts on a controversy surrounding school funding, while Hearst Connecticut Media editor and columnist Dan Haar added his thoughts on all the big stories around the state. And we will get to the Trump win in New Hampshire last night, the Joe Ganim win in Bridgeport in a little bit. But I felt I have to start with this, because there are times when I read stuff and I relate what I'm being, you know, alerted to by friends and sources of mine. And I read stuff and I wonder if the people saying what they're saying can be that tone deaf. Can they be that out of touch? Can they be that, I hate to use the word, but sometimes what comes out of Hartford and the majority leadership in Hartford is not even borderline. It is arrogant. And it often takes into account, everybody but the voters, but the constituents, the people who, no matter what party it is, vote for of their free will, the 36 men and women who make up the state Senate and the 151 men and women who make up the state House. So I get up this morning, and I miss yesterday. Thank you for hanging out with the best of. I'm back here. I'm home marginally. Going to try and struggle through today as I got hit with a cold or something, but I'm feeling a lot better than yesterday. So I felt I had to come on today and do this live. So I got up this morning struggling to get out of bed and taking as many medications and elixirs as my body will take. I think I found the right ratios so far. And somebody sends me a message and says, get a load of this. And I'm like, what? And they give me a link to a Connecticut News Junkie story. Lamont urges passes of EV regulations at an environmental summit. Now, there's two things to this. Both individually, you can take them for what they are. But then you put them together and say, who really matters here? Is there anything that the actual people can do, whether you vote for a Democrat or Republican, to let the powers that be in Hartford know that, like, you let them know that, no, you're not all-knowing, all-telling, you know, you're not Karnak here with the envelopes. There's an old reference. That we have to have a say here. And just some highlights from this story. And then my contact who gave me this said, scroll down and read this. Now, this comes from a Fairfield County legislator, a very prominent Democrat, who said something using a bit of a vulgarity, and he said, you can go ahead and quote me on that. Well, I'm going to in a moment. But the story begins, speaking to a sympathetic audience at a Tuesday environmental summit, Governor Lamont calling several times on advocates to lobby state lawmakers in favor of a contested plan to phase out eventually the sale of new gasoline-powered vehicles. Interesting that the governor would call on the advocates who are in favor of all this to make their voices heard, when I don't know what's more important, what the advocates want or what the men and women, the voters of Connecticut, want. The governor's remarks to the Connecticut League of Conservation Voters largely centered on encouraging passage of regulations he withdrew from consideration late last year amid opposition from the Bipartisan Review Committee. The plan would have Connecticut join California and several other states in phasing out the sale of new exclusively gas-powered vehicles by 2035. Now, let me, before I get to most of this story and the money quote, coming up by Westport Democrat Jonathan Steinberg, which is the money quote in this whole thing. Do any of these learned people in Hartford, the committee chairs, the men and women in the state house and state senate who are of the party, the majority, do they ever understand or realize, do they ever look in the mirror, figuratively, politically, or otherwise, and realize how lousy of a job they do in selling stuff like this? They were lousy selling tolls. They were lousy selling the Transportation Climate Initiative. Oh, it's just going to be extra money. Don't worry about it on the gas tanks. It's going to go for the climate. That job you did on TCI was beyond rotten, and nobody believed it. That's why you had to pull that, and that's largely why you're having trouble with this. The governor said, quote, "I just want you to make sure that you weigh in with the legislature," he told the summit. "Tell them this is not a nice to do, this is a must to do. Push back on the things that aren't true. Show we can do this and save you money. Show that when you're in a second-story walk-up in Waterbury, we can make this happen with a hybrid. And we'll also have a charging station for you nearby." Oh, really, Governor? Really? Where are those charging stations going to be? Well, they'll be nearby. No. People, do they not get it? Do they not get it? Or maybe they do and they just don't care. Well, we're going to make sure there are charging stations in the area. People are not dumb. They want to see concrete plans. If they live on Main Street in X Town, they live on such and such street in Waterbury. Okay, where am I going to be able to charge my EV? Governor Lamont, back to this story here in the Connecticut News Junkie, floated a proposal last week for the legislature to meet in a special session to pass a version of the plan, one that would allow Connecticut policymakers an opportunity in several years to assess the progress toward necessary infrastructure goals like adequate charging stations. Okay. So you're going to meet in a special session, which, by the way, folks, special sessions do not allow for public input. Shocking, eh? And here's the bottom line with this. And even if you look, like I say, I have nothing against EVs. Eventually, the vast majority of cars driven in this state and in this nation are going to be EVs. Again, it's turning a battleship. It takes time. But in an interview Tuesday, State Senate President Democrat Mark Looney said the issue remained under consideration by leaders as members of the legislature's Black and Hispanic and Puerto Rican caucus who've weighed in with concerns regarding the availability of chargers in lower-income communities. As well they should. This is this certainly at least sounds like or looks like a case of what Democrats do. Hey, give us your votes. We'll worry about it. No, I'm glad these Black and Puerto Rican caucus legislators are stepping up there saying, hey, wait a minute. Where are these chargers going to be? Looney saying, quote, "We're really concerned about the equity aspects of all this. We don't want to have a system whereby lower and moderate income people who don't have charging stations attached to where they live are going to have to go to public charging stations, and we don't want them to be in a position where they're going to have to pay more than people wealthy enough to have charging stations attached to their dwelling." Yes, Marty, you're right. I disagree with Marty Looney a lot. I've known him for years. But he's right on this one. Yet, you have the governor and the largely, white suburban environmental crowd going, oh, yes, we have to do this. Just trust us. It's going to be good. Oh, my God. Meantime, did you see what's going on here? This is a fire drill. They have 18 people running in 18 different locations, and they have no idea what they're doing. And then you have House Speaker Matt Ritter, who said Tuesday that the speaker, he favors a plan that would allow the state to revote on the regulations after 3 years and would require more investments in electric vehicle charging stations. Gee, you think? But wait, there's more. Yes, 2 a.m. in the morning infomercial when you can't sleep. And you've got agita, and you just downed a couple of shots of Pepto because you've got an early meeting and you have to go back to bed. The the eventual bill will likely include the creation of a committee. Ah, yes. To evaluate the state's progress toward infrastructure goals prior to an eventual re-vote on the regulations. Marty Looney saying a major caveat, quote-unquote, to the bill's progress will be the administration's willingness to address concerns raised by lawmakers. So understand something. You even have lawmakers answering to their constituents, mainly on the Democratic side, black and Hispanic motorists, residents of Connecticut, taxpaying people, who say, wait a minute, I'm going to get oosh-grade here. Now, scroll down as I can, as time is running short on this first segment. Republican State Representative Jonathan Steinberg, Democrat Westport. This is the quote he gave that had my phone blowing up this morning. Opposition to the regulations, along with messaging used by critics, have frustrated proponents in the legislature. On Tuesday, State Rep. Jonathan Steinberg, Democrat Westport, was among the state lawmakers participating in a panel discussion over environmental policy. After one such discussion, Steinberg said he still hoped to see the proposal okayed before the end of the month. Okay. He says, quote, every day that passes makes me more nervous, unquote. Nervous about what? What's going to happen? If we delay this thing a few years, or we delay it and say, hey, okay, we'll go ahead with it, but we want concrete plans as to where these charges are going to be. But he's nervous. Ooh. Here he goes again. Quote, the opposition has done a tremendously effective job of scaring the hell out of people, and that's where a lot of legislators are. So if you oppose this, at least like myself and other talk show hosts in the state do, in this form, we're scaring the hell out of people. Ugh. And here it is. He says they're hearing from their constituents a lot of bull, and he used the word. I won't say bull. He says, quote, they're hearing from their constituents a lot of bull, how should I say, spit. But he didn't say bull spit. He said bull. You can quote me on that. And we are, Representative Steinberg. Thank you very much. That's he may be your rep down there in Westport, Democrat Jonathan Steinberg. Okay, so here's my point. Before we go to break here, Representative Steinberg and anybody mainly on the Democratic side who's upset with this, maybe you need to do a little bit better of a job selling this? You think? You're worried about the bull. Well, it's politics. One of the ingredients on the label of politics is always going to be bull. How about you sell this better? And how about, Representative Steinberg and all the Democrats, you have better answers from the Black and Puerto Rican caucus to this whole thing, who rightfully are worried about how their constituents are going to charge these vehicles, right? You know, did anybody see the news last week and the week before about people standing there with their EVs in the middle of Chicago for 2 days, not being able to charge them? Or is that bull you-know-what, too? I ask back to open phones a little bit later on in the hour. When we do that, it'll be a 203-333-9422, 333-9422. WICC. Well, does Donald Trump have it all salted away, yes or no, after a convincing win that was just about what the pre-polling averages said was going to happen last night in New Hampshire? To talk about that, one of our go-to guys on all things nationally political, Professor Alan Sanders, former Time Magazine senior reporter, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at St. Peter's University in Jersey City, New Jersey. Professor Hyatt Paul again, good afternoon, and how are you, sir?
I'm fine, Paul. Good afternoon to you, too.
Is this over, Professor? Or if it's not, is it teetering on the edge for Nikki Haley?
Well, you know, in politics, it's never over until it actually is over. But I think right now the Trump train is rolling around, rolling along right on schedule as Trump wants it to. He's being annoyed, of course, by Nikki Haley and her refusal to get out of the race. She still thinks that she has a chance in South Carolina, and she's hoping to hang on at least until Super Tuesday, which comes in early March when we have a whole bunch of states, important states, that will be holding their primaries. Her Super PAC is still willing to support her, again, to Donald Trump's great annoyance, and he showed that last night in his victory speech, which wasn't really a victory speech, but a complaint speech against Nikki Haley. But certainly he looks like he's got it locked up or nearly locked up, but we'll have to see. I think Nikki Haley understands that. She thinks that she wants to hold on as long as possible, and I also think, like many anti-Trump Republicans, she's waiting to see whether Trump's legal troubles actually manage to hurt him when we actually get to a trial phase of his criminal cases.
Yeah, I'm a little maybe not surprised, but I don't blame her, Professor, for staying in here. It's only two contests, and I know what the projections say, but he's got a lot of, you know, things on his plate here that could suddenly turn things. You even had Ronna McDaniel, you probably saw that last night and today, saying, hey, let's unite behind the former president. I also think, Professor Sanders, that, you know, she wants to hang in a little more, so if she tries this again in 4 years, she maybe has the capacity to say, well, you know, I told you so, right? You didn't listen to me back then. I'm guessing that's a little of it, too, right now.
Yes, I think so. And, you know, we always say, you know, the early primaries are an expectations games, and they are, and they do set expectations. But let's be also a little realistic. I think in total, when we're looking at the Republican side of the primaries, only about 500,000 people voted. And to sort of say, well, on the basis of that tally of 500,000 people, we can now expect this to happen when millions of people still have yet to vote. That's really a condemnation of the entire primary process, which could be another discussion, Paul. But I think if you're a candidate and you've got a lot of money, and she still does have a fair amount of money, and you believe that your cause is correct and that you really want to make a case to the American people, you're not in such a great rush to be shown the door. I think you want to hang in a little more until things become really, clear that you don't have a path. So I think she's right to stay in. And if she has to go, she will decide that later on, but not at this point.
And maybe, Professor, and the guest, of course, is Professor Alan Sanders, maybe she wants to emphasize a point like this. I don't know whether you saw this today, Professor, but I was reading a breakdown of what happened last night by the Wall Street Journal. Very good article here. And understanding that, you know, the New Hampshire primary is a little different than others, 19% of Republicans who cast ballots in New Hampshire said they would be so dissatisfied with Trump as a nominee, they would not vote for him in November. That's I looked at that this morning and went, wow. What do you think?
Yeah, that's right. And so regardless of whether Nikki Haley wins the nomination or doesn't win the nomination, what she demonstrated last night in New Hampshire is there is a slice of Republican voters and certainly a bigger slice of independent voters that do not want Trump. Now, although Trump has, you know, cemented his MAGA support, he is exceedingly toxic among a huge swath of the general electorate. And this coming general election will be a very tight election. So if you lose any slice of what you presume to be your coalition, even if it's a tiny slice, that could be disastrous in the final election results in various states and in the Electoral College fight. So I think she did demonstrate that Trump may be a very strong Republican contender and very possibly the nominee of the Republican Party. She nonetheless showed that the Republicans have to be careful here because they may be getting a candidate that over and over again has lost the popular vote.
Yeah.
And that's the case that she's been making, of course, on the campaign trail. But I think her vote results in New Hampshire kind of support her claim that Trump could be, again, a losing candidate.
And also, I know there's a fear, Professor, and obviously you've talked about it with people, you've read about it, I have, the fear of the down-ballot damage that just wouldn't be in Congress. But I can tell you from here in Connecticut, you know, a lot of the state Democrats, quite properly, I think, from a tactical point of view, they make Trump an issue in state legislative races. And I think there's a fear out there among Republicans about what the down-ballot results could look like as well.
Yeah, I think that's right, because the Republican Party and Republican leaders and officials and elected office holders have, you know, sometimes held their nose. But in the end, they come around and back Donald Trump almost no matter what. And I think Democrats bank on that to make the case, not just at the presidential level, but at the lower office level, state houses, state elections, governorships, and, of course, House races and Senate races. I may have spoken about this with you before, but I also think there's another element here which could be problematic for the Republicans, and that is we all know that Biden doesn't do well in the polls as well. Mm-hmm. He has problems there. But when there have been local state elections, and particularly when abortion has been on the ballot and when democracy has been on the ballot, Democrats have done well, better than expected. And so I sometimes think that we may be seeing something like a reverse coattail effect. Typically, it's the president that has the coattails and brings along, it's a presidential candidate, I should say, that has the coattails and brings along, you know, people from his party in the down ballot elections. But we may be seeing something of a reverse, that the down ballot elections may actually help President Biden win re-election. Well, of course, we'll have to see whether that's true, but that's certainly a possibility, and that would be a very interesting development if true.
What happened with Ron DeSantis? I mean, here you had a guy, a 19-point win in his last run in a red state. I mean, I can remember the days when Florida was blue. It is solid red now. Ivy League guy, undergraduate at Yale, Harvard Law School, was in the JAG Corps, could talk policy till the cows come home. But did he just have no personality? What? And he spent like $160 million. What happened?
Yeah, good point and good question, Paul. I think it's a combination of two factors. I mean, they're always more than two, but the big two for me is that he didn't have the personality for a campaigner. You know, sometimes people just don't have the personality for the job they're seeking. That's not only true in politics. It's true in many other contexts. You just don't have the personality for that kind of career or that kind of job. For instance, not everybody can be a successful trial attorney, even if you're a lawyer. You don't have the personality for it. So I think that's part of the problem. But I also think that he made a gross miscalculation as to his strategy. He basically wanted to out-Trump Trump by going to the right of Trump and showing that, look, I'm even better than Trump. I'm a better copy of Trump. And I think he miscalculated that the Trump voter, the MAGA base, really likes Trump, and they're not looking for an alternative, and they don't trust an alternative. They like the basic brand of Trump, and any Trump-like brand to them didn't sound authentic enough. So I think that was the combination. He's not Trump, though he tried to be better than Trump, and he didn't have the personality for the requirements of campaigning.
Finally, Professor, and I know this is one of these questions that folks like you and I talk about every 4 years, but does Donald Trump think that he has to pick a woman to be his VP candidate, maybe to balance off and set up a contrast between whomever he picks and Kamala Harris, who we already see taking a little bit of a higher profile out there now with issues like you said, abortion? She was out there yesterday or today on immigration as well. I know they're talking about Elise Stefanik. That's an awful thin, you know, resume there. But again, she likes Trump, so there you go.
Well, I think certainly the people around him might suggest that a woman might be a good choice, or even an African-American candidate, like the senator from South Carolina that just endorsed him, Tim Scott. But I think ultimately for Donald Trump, I mean, he may pay attention to that, to the demographics element. But whatever the demographics, what he's going to be looking for is somebody who doesn't overshadow him, mm-hmm. who is basically a very quiet vice president once elected, if elected, and who basically genuflects in front of Donald Trump no matter what. Basically, Mr. Pence, Vice President Pence, mm-hmm. somebody who was always an apologist, who always genuflected in front of Trump during the course of the presidency, but ultimately decided in a moment of conscience to actually, follow the law. That's, what's his ultimate downfall among Republicans. But basically, he's looking for a fawning supporter. And I think there are fawning supporters that are both women or, African-American or any demographic that you can pick. So he'll pay attention to that. But the ultimate requirement will this be somebody who will be totally subservient to me, who will genuflect and be an apologist to the country about anything and everything that I do?
Always good to have former Time Magazine senior reporter and professor emeritus political science at St. Peter's in Jersey City, New Jersey, on with us, Professor Alan Sanders. Professor, thank you. Be in touch with you. We will down the road, and take care.
All right. You too. Take care, Paul.
Thank you, Professor Alan Sanders. Well, there you go. Former Time Magazine senior reporter, professor emeritus, political science at St. Peter's University in Jersey City, New Jersey. All right. We'll get back to open phones momentarily, a little later on to the hour. When we do that, 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. I was out yesterday, so I'm back today and couldn't talk with her yesterday, so she's on today, Megan Portfolio, who writes the Hartford Portfolio blog for the fine folks at the Yankee Institute of Connecticut. So Megan joins us today. Good afternoon, and how might you be?
Oh, I'm doing well. How are you? Are you feeling better?
I'm feeling a bit better, yes. As I told one of my callers earlier, I apparently, Megan, have found the right ratios of sugar, caffeine, 5-hour energy, Aleve, and DayQuil. So I've mixed them all.
Oh, thank goodness.
And I think I'll be okay for at least the next 2 hours, or rather 1 hour and 46 minutes. Now, a couple things on your docket. Now, what do I see here? We have a controversy, shocking, not, over a charter school here and school funding and a minority caucus here in Hartford. What's going on with that?
Yes. So we have this Black and Puerto Rican caucus, that represents the folks in the state at the Capitol. And in the caucus is Senator Matt Lester, which I didn't realize this. He's part of the caucus because I believe his mother is from Argentina. I'm not 100% sure because I had actually a link to the article and I went to go, through my notes before I came on the air, and the article suddenly disappeared. It was on the CT Latino News. So the article isn't there anymore. And when I did a search for Matt Lester on their website, nothing came up. So from the little bit that's on the internet that I was able to find, apparently his mother is Argentinian. Okay. So that's fine. So he's on the caucus. But there's this group of Black leaders in the Middletown area are having a serious issue with him being on that caucus because his voting record is not reflective of the wants and needs of the Black and Puerto Rican communities in the state, including, and what started this whole thing was this charter school in Middletown. You guys in your area had the same kind of issue in Danbury, where the funding was there. It was earmarked by Appropriations Committee, and all of a sudden at 11:48 p.m. last day of session, it magically disappeared. No one knows anything. Lester was in cahoots apparently with Senator Jan Hockadell in Meriden, who is also a teacher union president.
She's been on the show. Yes, I've talked to her. Yes, she is. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then her union is absolutely against charter schools. And coincidentally, most charter schools aren't unionized. So, it's all about the money with these union bosses. But
the sad thing is with that, Megan, we should set up this point here. A lot of charter schools have Black and Hispanic kids in there because a lot of their other schools that they would have to go to suck. So this is why a lot of Black and Hispanic legislators and parents want charter schools to set up a better alternative for many kids who would otherwise have to go to lousy schools. But the teachers' unions can't stand them.
No, and then another thing about this particular charter school, it's the Capitol Preparatory Charter School. They also have I'm going to call it a branch. It's from my past corporate life, but they have like a branch in Bridgeport, and they're also located in New York. And if you look at the ratio of Black and or non-white educators in their school, it's a pretty high percentage. And they actually do, they do base their hiring, and they say this on their website, on your you know, your credentials and your ability, but they do strive to have a more diverse staff, which has been proven to help, you know, minority kids. And it's way higher than at the public school system. So like, you're really putting, you know, a lot of people in these communities, you know, at risk. You're leaving them in these schools. The parents are demanding, like, because I live in Middletown, and the parents want this school. They want the option to send their school there for a number of reasons. I mean, it could be for bullying, and it could be, you know, poor performing public schools. And it's a, this is what the parents want. Like, these are the taxpayers. Why are you going against them? And you're doing it, you know, 12 minutes before midnight, last day of session, and then you say nothing about it. And that's and what this petition is all about.
Yeah, and the whole thing is, Megan, it's, I've always kind of laughed at this in the years I've been doing shows on this, because it's like, okay, if you allow one or two charter schools in your district, it doesn't mean the public schools are going away. Nobody's going to snap their finger and say, well, hey, this is the answer, because logistically, it's not. But my God, the thought that just some kids would have a choice, as you say, which would better fit their current status, just upsets some people to no end.
And it's like, and it's based on, like, this specific community. Yes, is every charter school wonderful and the answer to everything? No. And you know what happened to them? They close. But that option isn't in the public school system. We continue to give them money. We continue to pump money into them, give them whatever they want. They use the money. Like, if you look at it, the administrative costs in these public schools, it's ridiculous. These administrators are getting paid obscene amount of money for poor performance. So why not give, you know, parents option to send them to these schools? And if you're so scared of, you know, a competitor, what do you do in business? If you have a competitor open up, you need to focus on your product and improve your product. And if your product is, you know, awesome, no one's going to leave. They're going to stay in the public school system. They're not going to go to this charter school. But you're not improving your product. I mean, look at the test scores now, and especially after COVID, what they did with the school closures. These kids need an option. Otherwise, you know, they're never going to dig themselves out of this hole.
Absolutely. And an option doesn't mean, as you said, Megan, they're causing the other people to shut down. Sometimes options are complementary. So we have that with this charter school. And also, and I talked about this early on, and you and I chatted about this via text today, this whole thing, again, with the governor, you know, pleading to get this EV drawdown mandate in there. And again, Megan, it just fascinates me, because they're angry at people at me that do shows like this and other people that don't want that. But to me, Megan, you've been following this stuff for years. If that's the case, then they've got to sell it better. And they've got to sell it better to, number one, I guess, legislators who are hearing from, you know, low and low to moderate income people saying, hey, how am I going to do this in 8 or 10 years? They've got to sell this better.
And, gee, is it an election year? I mean, come on, guy. Like, it's getting to the point, like, I exist to, like, have them just play political games and not do it. Like, they don't do anything for us anymore. All they do is just play games and use gimmicks to push whatever agenda, you know, their special interests want. I mean, a colleague of mine, David Fleming, he published a report. He went through all the comments during the initial public hearing on this. And overwhelmingly, the public is opposed to this. And now they pull this. They want to have an emergency special session. I guess we've redefined emergency.
It's an emergency.
1 week. Yeah, 1 week. Like, the earth is on fire. We need to do this 1 week before the session starts, which coincidentally doesn't go through the committee process, which doesn't let lawmakers put in amendments, which doesn't let the public have their say. And then they're trying to sell this watered down garbage of, oh, well, let's form a committee and we'll readdress this in 3 years. In the meantime, we're not in compliance with you know, the federal law. We either have to follow California or we have to follow the federal law. And we're doing neither right now. And now they're throwing this nonsense in here because it's an election year where, oh, let's form a committee and we'll kick the can down the road, you know, that typical General Assembly fashion, and we'll deal with it in 3 years. And then they start throwing this crap in about like the hybrids, which hybrids are awesome, like the gas-powered hybrids.
Yeah.
You know, when
yeah.
I'm in the market for a new car, I may think about getting one. But okay. the rule, the California rule, is only allowing car manufacturers to sell 20% of their whole line to be gas-powered hybrid. So So now so according to these lawmakers, everyone wants these hybrids. So now you have this huge demand, according to them, but supply is really low. What do you think it's going to do to that price? The one hybrid that is available is this hydrogen option, which have you seen a hydrogen fill-up station? Where do I get my hydrogen? We can't even handle the electrical infrastructure, and now you're going to have like a whole new...
Oh my God! Hang on, honey. Listen, on the way home, I got to get milk and eggs, and I'm going to pick up some hydrogen for your car.
That's absurd. And the hydrogen cars are more expensive than the regular electric cars. So now you're literally not addressing any of the concerns that the public is having.
And Megan, here's the thing. This will eventually happen. You and I, we get around, we see more and more EVs, straight electric vehicles, gasoline electric hybrids out there. The consumer decides. This is like turning a battleship. This is going to take 10, 15, 20, or 30 years. But I would hazard to guess 30, 40, 50 years from now, when I'm not around anymore, perhaps the majority of vehicles will in fact be electric. But to try and mandate this, especially when you have majority Democrat lawmakers, say like Marty Looney, hello, and some people like that saying, hey, my constituents at least now can't afford this. It's got to make you think. It's maddening.
I don't know when it turned into government thinking that they are our mommy and daddy. I will choose the car that I can buy, and I'm going to base my choice on what I can afford and what I can finance. Mm-hmm. People like Martin Looney are in very safe districts. He could literally run for all eternity and win. So he can do these kind of things. But it's like, dude, come on, man. Think about your constituents. I lived in New Haven County. I lived in an apartment complex. Where was I going to charge my car? There's no infrastructure there. When am I going to run a cord into my apartment? I mean, come on.
You imagine that? Just this 100-foot extension cord.
That's what they do in Cambridge, by the way. They had to pass an ordinance where people can run cords from their apartments to the street, and they have to get these ADA pads to go over it. Yeah. So the typical government should not be in the business of business.
So you mean to tell me in Cambridge around Harvard, and I was there plenty of times, I'm a BU guy. So you mean to tell me people run extension cords out of their windows?
Yes, sir. They have to purchase them or rent them. Or no, I think they can get them on Amazon. It's these special pads that go over the cord, over the sidewalk, it's ADA compliant. Because you can't tripping on it or people in wheelchairs or, you know, with walkers. It's a hazard to them, you know.
I'm sorry.
They're running extension cords.
There's a Benny Hill bit somewhere there, but I'm not going to go into
it. Oh, you're showing your age. I'm showing my age. I know Benny Hill.
There you go. Megan Portfolio, she blogs at the Yankee Institute. Check out the Hartford Portfolio. Megan, thanks, and we'll chat next week. Thanks.
Hey, have a good week.
You too. Megan Portfolio. I didn't know they did that in Cambridge. Oh, Harvard Square. Okay, back to open phones in just a bit. And when we do that, of course, to wrap up the show, it'll be a 203-333-9422-333-WICC. But checking in with us right now, as he does every Wednesday at this time, Dan Harhurst, Connecticut media editor and columnist. Mr. Har, good afternoon, sir. And how are you today?
Great. Doing okay.
Excellent. Are we ready for Ghanem Gomes round 4, Dan, or you think it ends here?
Oh, it effectively ends. If Gomes, first of all, my understanding, it sort of from a little bit of a distance, is that they can't skip the general election. You have to have a general election.
Yeah.
And there, of course, there were candidates on the general election ballot who were not involved in the primary. Mm-hmm. So they have a right to a general election. But however, the race is over. Gomes can't win. Gomes already couldn't win because he didn't bother to differentiate himself from Joe Ghanem. He gambled that if he spent the whole election saying, I'm not Joe Ghanem, that people would believe him and vote for him. And he failed because, as we saw with Justin Elliker 5 years ago, you have to actually say who you are. And he didn't do that, and so he didn't win. And he has no chance of winning now because, A, he's out of money, and, B, he's out of steam. And I don't know that he's issued a statement. Has he? today. Has he issued a statement saying
effectively? I haven't seen anything, Dan. I don't know. You may have seen it. I have not. No, no.
I have not. The mayor issued a statement saying it's over, and he's right. So Joe Ganim is the mayor for the next 4 years, and that's that. And for better or worse, that's what you have. The race is over. However, there may be some electoral cleanup to be done between now and then. The race really was over before because Mr. Gomes just didn't do what he had to do to be a winning candidate. Simple as that.
Yeah, and Dan, listen, everybody knows who Joe Ganim is. They know he's from his first terms. They know what happened. They know now. And I thought he was effective mostly to the better part of him sounding that way in the end when he essentially said that. Look, you know who I am, but here's what we're getting done for the city of Bridgeport. And I think, Dan, sometimes, not always, but sometimes it's that old axiom, hey, are the streets getting cleaned, shoveled? Does the garbage get picked up? Do the police and fire department come when I call? And I think, Dan, not always, but to a great part, that's what people judge their local politics on.
Hey, if people can say Donald Trump would be a good president because he's a seasoned business executive, then they can say Joe Ganim is a great mayor because he's a seasoned mayor, which he is. And I have nothing against him. I don't think he's doing a bad job or a good job as mayor. It's a tough, tough job being mayor of the city in Connecticut that's not only the largest and one of the poorest cities, but that which really doesn't have the built-in advantages of a Stamford, New Haven, or Hartford. Each one of those has a huge, gargantuan built-in advantage. Bridgeport has none of them.
Dan Haar with us. Dan, it's almost comical. Every story I read about this EV mandate thing, and now we're talking about a special session, and some legislators are not happy. Jonathan Steinberg let loose with a few interesting thoughts to one of the publications in the state. Is it going to be a public input thing? Is it not going to be the governor telling the environmental lobby to bang down the doors and write emails and calls? And boy, I got to tell you, Dan, you and I have talked about this ad nauseum already. This is starting to look kind of like a circular firing squad. Maybe not yet, but every day it's something different with this.
Well, the plan has changed significantly. The overall effort is still what the overall effort is, and that is to get Connecticut to become the, I think, 15th or 17th or 18th state to join the California standards. Mm-hmm. I'm curious to know, I did not see what Representative Steinberg said, and he's in a key position now. Is he saying he would rather have it with hearings during the session?
Well, give me 2 seconds here.
While you're doing that, let me just go over my latest understanding of the latest plan. Okay. And that is this, which I reported in a column yesterday, which was in which I said that the governor is admired in the environment environmental advocacy community, mm-hmm. but is seen as not doing quite enough arm twisting among legislators who are reticent. So my understanding of the latest plan is either in special session or very early in the regular session in February, certainly, they do two things. They adopt a 3-year mandatory vote in 3 years and 27. We vote again, and if we vote it down, it doesn't take effect. And they create a commission to make it all happen and to report back on how the industry is doing and whether it's ready. Those are seen as compromises. Then you either go to regulations review, which didn't have the votes because of the two Democrats who wouldn't vote for it, mm-hmm. and you let them vote for it given this new compromise, or you jam it down – not jam it down, excuse me. You have public hearings and you bring it to a vote in the General Assembly regular session. And those are so that's a sort of a two-step process that's being envisioned.
So nobody is
not doing anything. There's no darkness of night or anything like that.
Jonathan Steinberg was quoted here. This is in the Connecticut News Junkie, and from what I understand in my context at the Capitol, Dan, this was making the rounds this morning. Steinberg said, quote, in the News Junkie, "Every day that passes makes me more nervous. The opposition has done a tremendously effective job of scaring the hell out of people, and that's where a lot of legislators are. They're hearing from their constituents a lot of bull," and he used the word, let me just say bull spit. He used the actual word. "You can quote me on that," unquote. And I read that at the beginning of my show, Dan. I said, well, okay, maybe you feel that way. That's fine. But, again, you've got Martin Looney in the same article saying, well, my constituents, you know, it seems to me that they've got to do a better job Dan, of delineating, and you and I have talked about this, getting specific about this, delineating, even if they can't be specific about the fact that you can't be specific. You know what I mean?
It's very specific. The problem is that there's a lot of disinformation going around. It's absolutely not true, and no one's taking your cars away. There's no freedom issue in this. That's nonsense. The market is changing over to an electric vehicle model. We think that by 2035, by we, I mean the people watching this, not me. This is, I'm speaking the voice of. We think that by 2035, the market is pretty much going to be all electric for new cars. GM and Ford have said they are aiming at doing that, but they've had some setbacks lately. If the market isn't ready by then, no state is going to mandate it. This idea that we're taking your guns away is just misinformation. By the way, I gather that Representative Steinberg said bull snit, but you wouldn't want to say that on the air.
No, he said something close to that, but I. Dan, you also want to talk about last night and our primary, April 2nd, which I even wish was even sooner. I'd like to see us actually matter. Nikki Haley, will she still be viable? She certainly, Dan, sounds like she's not going anywhere yet. And I think she has a bit of an axe to grind and she wants to make a point.
Well, she's also the last person standing, and there's no reason for the last person standing to exit, because if something should happen to the front runner, either, perhaps he runs into some legal problem, mm-hmm. perhaps he becomes convicted of a felony that prohibits three of the felonies, as I believe it's three of them having to do with insurrection, would actually bar him from running. So there's some circumstances where he would not be able to run. And so the last person standing would be a lunatic to get out, because you're in. You're the next person there. So it's incumbent on her to stay in. That said, February 24th is the South Carolina primary. The media is widely reporting today the millions of dollars that are pouring into South Carolina. You want to be a sales rep for a network affiliate TV station in Columbia, South Carolina today. Today is Christmas times 1,000 for you. Money is going to pour in. Donald Trump is going to have to take the state a little bit more seriously than he's taken anything this year on the campaign trail. And we'll just have to see. It's a long shot for her still, and it's an even longer shot for her to be viable by the time we vote on April 2nd. But I hope we have such an election.
All right. Dan Harhurst, Connecticut media editor and columnist and observer of all things around Connecticut. Dan, thank you.
I just want to say one quick thing, if
sure.
I have a second, and that
sure.
is watch. Everybody, I can't say what it is now, but if you care about the election, the primary, watch for my column tomorrow morning on all of the Hearst Connecticut Media CT Insider websites.
I will make sure, Dan, I promise you, once I stumble out of bed and do what I have to do, I will pull that up on my screen first thing tomorrow. I promise you, okay?
You will be surprised.
All right, Dan Harr, thanks. Take care, and we'll talk to you next week. Thanks.
Thank you. Take care.
All right, Dan Harr there, Hearst Connecticut Media. He's got, he's promoted his column.